If you want to support the show, you can go to mwpnews.com/support, where you can pick up my latest book, Succession Planning, and all my other books that have previously been released on Kindle for only $2.99 each. Thank you. Good morning, and welcome to 30 Minute Reviews. I am Adam. Let's just get right into it. We got a lot to talk about today. Let's just bring up our article. We have a new segment we're going to do a little bit later called The Call Sheet. We're going to get into that in a little bit. Let's start out with This Week in Podcasts. On Tuesday on the Backlog Files, I will be going through the games we've already reviewed for the Pokemon ranking and assigned them star scores. Wednesday on Beware of Spoilers, I'll be discussing Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Thursday, we'll be discussing the 9th episode of X-Men 97. Friday, we will be discussing The Bad Batch in its entirety. And Saturday, we will be finishing up with The Girls on the Bus. This evening, we will be talking about, Heir to the Empire, Tales from the Empire, the new show. The schedule may be adjusted as additional screening times are added toward the end of the week, and we will be announcing our Tribeca coverage in the near future. This week in winners from the indie space, we await the Cannes Film Festival, but there are still a few domestic festivals that have wrapped up recently. Let's start out with the San Francisco International Film Festival. Here are the big winners from that. The Global Visions Award went to Great Absence. The documentary feature, Best Documentary Feature, went to Sugarcane. Best Bay Area Documentary Feature went to Seeking Mavis Beacon. And if you go to the article on MWPNews.com that accompanies this podcast, you'll be able to see our coverage there. We have a link. Narrative short went to Bogota Story. Documentary short went to The Medallion. Animated short went to La Pera. Audience award for narrative feature went to The Teacher, and the audience award for documentary feature went to Agent of Happiness. And keep in mind, I believe San Francisco is one of the Academy Award qualifying ones, so those three shorts could be in contention for best short in their category. The big event this month is Cannes, but the Seattle Film Festival will be starting later this week. If you are in Seattle, they have a surprisingly strong lineup. Babes and I Saw the TV Glow will both be screening. Those are both opening in the near future. But also, several movies we've already talked about will be there as well. Bob Trevino Likes It, Aggro Drift, Sing Sing, In a Violent Nature, and Porcelain War will all be there. In addition to that, the Brooklyn Rooftop Films screening series will be starting over the course of the next few weeks with opening night on May 17th. This will be a series of short films, including Bug Diner, which took home awards at both South by Southwest and Sundance. So let's move into the stories for this week. Story number one, Sony has made a $26 billion offer to buy Paramount. This is hands down the biggest story of the week, and it's Sony and Apollo teaming up to make a $26 billion offer to buy out Paramount, a studio that was rumored to be up for sale a few times over the last year or so. This would move Sony from the fourth place position in market share behind Universal, Disney, and Warner Brothers to the third place spot, just behind Disney and Universal in that order. Disney at number two, Universal at number one, and give Sony a massive trove of IP to work with in the future. This buyout would also be less contentious with regulators across the globe than Disney buying 20th Century Fox back in 2019, since the key thing there, the terrestrial television stations, is not a factor here, considering while Paramount does own CBS, Sony does not have terrestrial television in that same way, on general broadcast. To be clear, industry consolidation is bad for consumers and it limits choice, and it's bad for the industry because it typically leads to layoffs and won't limit the number of options that filmmakers have to sell their movies. That said, Paramount has been in a weird situation in the last few years where it hasn't been run exceptionally well, so maybe a change in leadership is better long-term than what is there right now. I mean, case in point, their biggest success in television is CBS, which is, you know, hands down the number one station in the United States and Nickelodeon, but Knuckles is the largest streaming title for Paramount Plus, which tells you a lot considering it's also the home for all of Star Trek and the expanded universe to come out of Yellowstone, which is a huge hit for them. It does beg the question how many people are actually watching their new content as well. This would also presumably give Sony a massive foothold in the streaming space, which they don't have. They don't have a streaming service. They typically partner with Netflix or Disney Plus, but giving them their own designated home, which would be Paramount Plus, would change things up. That said, I don't exactly trust Sony to handle this treasure trove of IP well, considering Sony's past track record of the IP they do own. Outside of the collaborations with Marvel Studios for the Spider-Man movies, they've shown a systemic ineptitude when it comes to handling their franchises. Ghostbusters has not been great in years. Anything Spider-Man adjacent that hasn't had Kevin Feige's fingerprints on it or been animated has been awful, and Men in Black has been languishing ever since the last entry crashed and burned, including a team-up with 21 Jump Street. Now, they do have Bad Boys coming out later this year, but I don't think they're going to really bring things around on that. I don't think giving them the Transformers franchise will miraculously improve the franchise, but the continuing dysfunction within Sony could just serve to keep things in the situation they are in right now. Of particular interest to me is how this will affect the first-party video game market, since it's unclear how much of the underlying IP rights, will remain with Paramount in this case, because that was a big point of contention with Sony owning Spider-Man. If you recall, the idea that, you know, Sony was looking to be bought out at a certain point was like, well, if someone buys it, then the rights of Spider-Man would revert back to Marvel Studios. So the question is, if Paramount's bought, would that move Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and all these other IP that they own, would those revert back to the original rights holders? And then if not, do they retain the video game rights? And if so, does that mean that they could become PlayStation exclusive? So that would, if it is the latter, and it's the biggest umbrella staying, Transformers, Mission Impossible, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, anything produced by Nickelodeon and Star Trek could become first-party titles under PlayStation. Now, I'm not saying that's going to affect anything in production. They're not going to backtrack on making The Last Ronin multi-platform. But we're also probably not going to get Sony, you know, working on, Sony Santa Monica working on a SpongeBob game. But opening up Star Trek or Transformers to Sony's first-party developers could produce some good content in that regard. It'll be interesting to see, like, say, I had this idea the other day, like, we're talking about an upcoming G.I. Joe Transformers crossover. That seems weird. Until you say, what if we do that as a Shadow of the Colossus-type situation? It could be interesting then. But we'll have to wait and see on all of that. Story number two, Disney has released a trailer for the upcoming movie Mufasa the Lion King, which is our first look at a movie that is slated for release in a crowded December, and I'm not counting Kraven because I'm not entirely certain Kraven comes out ever, if at all, this year. This is Mufasa the Lion King, which is a prequel about Mufasa from The Lion King, as directed by Barry Jenkins. I think this trailer does a lot to really assure me this movie could be good. These live-action remakes tend to work best when they aren't one-to-one remakes of the original movie. Like, Mulan, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast have been okay. Pinocchio, Lady and the Tramp, Peter Pan and Wendy have been not good. And the quality of those only ever cap out is fine. The ones that take liberties, like Cruella, Maleficent, Christopher Robin, have been higher quality. Since Mufasa is telling a somewhat original story and playing fast and loose with the existing canon, and putting them in a situation where it's like, oh, Mufasa was adopted, and now he's, you know, and he and Scar have this question of who's going to lead, it could lead to some interesting storytelling. That said, I also implicitly trust Barry Jenkins with my life, let alone delivering a good movie, so we'll see how this all pans out. Story number three, Super Nintendo World is going to be opening at Epic Universe in 2025. I don't think we've talked about this yet, but Universal is opening a third theme park in Orlando. If, for those who don't know, Universal currently has two parks, Universal Studios Orlando and Islands of Adventure. Those are two theme parks that are next to each other, kind of like how in, what's it called, in Anaheim, Disneyland and California Adventure are like next to each other with a central area between them. This third park they're opening is called Epic Universe. It opens next year, and it has several themed areas based on How to Train Your Dragon, The Dark Universe, which is all the Universal monsters. There's another Harry Potter section based on the Ministry of Magic, and an East Coast version of Super Nintendo World. We've already gotten some information about Celestial Park, which is the central hub world, and the Isle of Burke from How to Train Your Dragon. This week we got information about Super Nintendo World, and it's kind of what we expected it would be. There's three rides, there's a Mario Kart augmented reality ride, there is a family-friendly Donkey Kong Dark Coaster, and a Yoshi-themed ride where you look for multicolored eggs. This is the least interesting deeper look into this park that we could have had because it looks kind of the same. And it looks kind of like what we've gotten already twice already with the one in Japan and the one in Hollywood. The big deviation would have come had they been like, oh, and by the way, we have this thing from Legend of Zelda, or, oh, we have a Metroid thing that's going to be here. But this just looks more like the pictures I've seen of the other two parks. There's nothing new there. I'm curious about Dark Universe because, you know, the other two areas we've seen are doing like a Disney level of immersion. I want to see if Dark Universe does that same thing. Because Universal, like, if you've been to Universal compared to Disney, Universal doesn't feel like a immersion. You're not in that world. You're in a theme park with these themed areas, but, like, very clearly you could see around. Disney cares about eyelines and all of that. This looks like it's doing, you know, the Disney approach. I'm also curious about if this park will be expandable to do more stuff in the future, something that Disney also does, and what Universal recently did with their Harry Potter expansions. I'm curious as to if we will get more in these parks, or if it's just the space they have is the space they have, and then we just gotta deal with it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Story number four, Netflix and Greg Berlanti are working on a live-action Scooby-Doo series. I debated putting it in here because Greg Berlanti does have a little bit of a spotty track record when it comes to adapting existing IP that's not a DC comic book, but Greg Berlanti is partnering with Netflix again to produce another live-action adaptation of a beloved IP, in this case, Scooby-Doo. And even saying spotty feels a little dismissive since he has definitely more hits than misses, like, because he actively developed, like, Everwood, Arrow, The Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, You, Supergirl, Superman, and Lois, so he's got a solid track record. And even if you look at the ones that were just done by his production company and he didn't have his hands on directly, it's like Riverdale ran for 7 seasons, whether or not you like it. All American, The Girls on the Bus, Black Lightning, The Flight Attendant, Blind Spot, Prodigal Son, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. The misses outnumber the hits. The hits outnumber the misses. And it's easy to point to something that was publicly floundering, like Powerpuff, that we never actually saw, but a script got leaked, and say it would be bad, but let's see where it goes and how this whole thing kind of, you know, ends off. And I think, too, it's like, it'll depend how it actually works. Like, is this actually going to be a direct, like, Scooby-Doo kind of adaptation, or is it going to be more, I think it's going to be more Riverdale, where it's, you know, a darker take on it. Let's see how it goes, though. Story number five, Starfield's receiving a major update in May. We're now 8 months out from the release of Starfield on PC and Xbox, and we are finally getting the quality of life updates that should have been in the game since day one. These updates include performance mode to play at 60 frames per second, improved maps on the surface, and improved fast travel system, new difficulty options, and more ship-to-core options. They've also teased further updates coming in the future, including a ground-based ship for land traversal. I enjoyed the game. You can check out our review on Beware of Spoil... Yeah, Beware of Spoilers. That was before the backlog files. Over on Beware of Spoilers, I did do a review. There should be a link in the article on the website where you can, you know, go to it. And my biggest criticism were these problems, and they do all appear to be fixed. Let's see if they actually work in practice, but if this is the case, this may get me back into the game. And now for our new segment, the call sheet. This will be a segment we do every week where we talk about the biggest casting news that happened. Where we talk about actors, writers, directors who have been attached to existing projects. So let's just get down to it. Co-director Sion Heder, which I'm fairly certain I mispronounced, will adapt the hit novel Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow for Paramount. Hugh Jackman and Jodie Comer have signed on to star in Michael Sarnowski's The Death of Robin Hood. Zazie Beetz and Elizabeth Debicki have both signed on to star in This Blue Is Mine from Iuli Gerbaz. I really got to start checking this out. Simon Farnaby, who you may know from the writer of Wonka, who appeared in Wonka as well, his next family film, The Magic Faraway Tree, has signed both Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy. Rosamund Pike has joined Now You See Me 3. John Carney's next film, Power Ballad, has landed both Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas as leads. Janelle Monáe and Missy Elliott have both joined Pharrell Williams' currently untitled upcoming musical project, which I believe is animated as well. Paul Walter Hauser has joined the Fantastic Four in an undisclosed role, but it's probably Herbie, if I were to venture a guess. Louis Leterrier has signed on to direct the upcoming science fiction horror film 11817, which I feel like is how you would do that, not 11817. Robin Wright will star in and direct The Girlfriend for Amazon, which will also star Laurie Davidson and Olivia Cooke. Ben Schnetzer has joined the upcoming film about the creation of Bumble, The Dating App, which will also star Lily James. The upcoming 80s vampire thriller from the director of Mandy, Flesh of the Gods, has signed Kristen Stewart and Oscar Isaac in the lead. Andrew Haig, who you may know from All of Us Strangers, will direct the upcoming Leonardo da Vinci biopic for Universal. Encore from Simon Curtis has signed Glenn Close, Jeremy Irons, Henry Winkler, and Don Johnson in major roles. Emma Stone and Nathan Fielder will produce Checkmate for A24 about the recent cheating scandal that affected the chess, everything. Travis Knight has signed on to direct Sony's upcoming Masters of the Universe film that is slated for release in 2026. Jessica Biel and Elizabeth Banks will star in Better Sisters for Amazon. Neil McDonough has joined the second season of Tulsa King, which stars Sylvester Stallone on Paramount Plus. Gemma Arterton has signed on to lead Storm Witch from David Blair. Carla Gugino will be playing Vivian Leigh in the biopic entitled The Florist, and Jeff Bridges will be returning for Tron: Ares. This week at the box office, Fall Guy has kind of underperformed domestically, but here are the results. The Fall Guy has took home the number one spot with 28.5 million. Star Wars Episode I: The Phantom Menace came in second with 8 million. Challengers fell all the way to third with 7.6 million. Newcomer Tarot Cards, 6.5 million. And number five, Godzilla and Kong: The New Empire with 4.5 million. Coming to theaters this week, we have one major release, and that is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes with Wes Ball directing. It continues the reboot trilogy of Planet of the Apes, and it stars Owen Teague and Freya Allen. Coming to physical media this week, the only major DVD release is The Taste of Things, which got a wide theatrical release in February back in the United States. This movie's probably most famous for being France's select to represent the country at the Academy Awards last year instead of Anatomy of a Fall due to Justine Triet's open criticism of the current French PM Macron. And the state of the current government in France. The Taste of Things did end up making the shortlist, but did not get nominated. And the award did end up going to Zone of Interest. Which brings us to our final thing. We have a little bit of time, so we have two more things. First impressions of The Acolyte. We got a new trailer, and we're a little under a month away from the release of Lucasfilm's next Disney Plus show, The Acolyte, set about 100 years before Phantom Menace. It appears to be about the rise of the Sith in the lead up to the Skywalker saga, and this weekend we were given two new looks at this show, including a trailer released Saturday morning and an extended look attached to the Episode I theatrical re-release. So, I have two key things about this that really interest me. It appears The Acolyte is going to lean into some of the more interesting metaphysical aspects of the Force, especially considering Acto appears to be heavily featured in both trailers, Acto being the world that Luke secluded himself to after attempting to kill Kylo. I don't remember, what was the exact thing? Was it after trying to kill Kylo Ren and he went into hiding? No, I feel like there was other things after that. Whatever. That's where Rey found him, at the end of Force Awakens, and then we saw throughout the entirety of Last Jedi. There's a lot of weird things that happen there, and there's a lot of, like, there's that weird butthole of darkness and stuff like that. So I'm interested to see where that plays and how that affects, this rising tide of darkness in this period. The other key is that they're putting a lot of attention on the action and making sure the fight choreography is top-notch. This could be something really special. I'm very interested in this show, in a way that I wasn't really quite as much for, like, what was the other big one? Like, I'm more interested in this than I was in Andor going into it, and I think that this show has more potential than Andor at this point. I don't know if it'll be as good as Andor, but I think it's going to be up there in that same conversation. And before we go, one final thing. I did rewatch Mad Max: Fury Road recently, in prep for Furiosa, because I haven't seen this movie since I watched it in 2015 when it came out on DVD. So it's been almost a decade since I watched this movie. And one of the things that always struck me really as kind of funny was the trailer have it ending with, like, remember her, and like, remember her, period. I'm like, that could just be a question mark because it's like, how many people are going to remember this? But one of the things that really struck me about this movie is that it really came out at the perfect time. And there was a thing that went around a few weeks ago, or a few maybe months ago at this point, where it was like, what's a piece of media that's indicative of the before times? And I think Furiosa might be it. I think Furiosa might be the perfect piece of media that is indicative of the before times. Because people, this will be the thing that's like, if it came out today, like we talk about with Star Wars all the time, if Star Wars came out today, the same people who hold Star Wars up and are like, this is fantastic, would hate it because, you know, Leia has so much autonomy and all of that. This is the same thing. Where you're taking the Mad Max franchise, you're putting it in the hands of ostensibly a female lead, giving it to where a bunch of women are doing like the lion's share of the work, and are even fixing the key character defect of Max. All of it works in the movie. But this movie came out in 2015. We didn't get the grift machine that we now have until a year later with Ghostbusters 2016 reboot. That was the point that things kind of shifted. And also, when was Gamergate in this whole thing? Because I feel like that was kind of... this had to have been pre-Gamergate. And the issue with this is, if this movie came out today, identically, with the same action sequences, it would have been torn apart by the same people who hold it up and will inevitably hold it up in 2 weeks when Furiosa comes out. Because we didn't get to the point where it's like, if you go back and read reviews of The Last Jedi from the people who do this, the ones that came out the day of are a lot more glowing. Then they start figuring out how to unify the message. What are we going to complain about? And then once they get this cohesive kind of, this is what we're going to complain about, everyone gets it together. Mad Max Fury Road, the movie that if it came out today, would be the subject of that vitriol. Regardless of how good the movie is. Regardless of the underlying things. That's going to be the point where it's like, oh, this is, you know, this is woke. This is people doing what they want to do with my beloved IP that I always loved Mad Max. And now look what they did. They put a woman in the lead. That is something that would have happened if this movie came out 6 months later, a year later. Like 9 years ago from today, Mad Max Fury Road was coming out. It wouldn't be for another 10 months, because it was March of 2016 that the first trailer was released for the Ghostbusters reboot by Sony. That, you know... And look, Gamergate was still... I just looked it up. Gamergate was still reasonably new at the time that this happened. Like, yeah, it had all, you know, transpired by this point, but it broke in October of 2014. So it's not that long of a period before we get to here, and that's when we get into this culture war thing. This was still too new for that to be a big deal. In the same way that, like, if Annie came out today, we would hear about it nonstop the way we hear about Snow White nonstop, or heard about Snow White nonstop, or heard about Little Mermaid nonstop. It's that kind of situation. But I digress. We'll wrap up there for today. Until our next episode, have a great rest of your week.